So we're going to start with pick up with chapter 1 today. I think I'm just going to keep one document, and so chapter 1's on one side. If and when we get to chapter 2, it'll be on the other side. I think there's not a whole lot in chapter 1. I thought it was excellent material, and for me, I know it was really helpful just as a reminder, and I'm hoping it was helpful for you all just to have a sense of a little bit of the background of our church, kind of where we come out of, and the progression. And that's kind of where I want to start, is with the history of the church. The first note I have there is just to draw some attention to the that illustration at the very beginning of the chapter, of the bridge to nowhere, that they had built this really beautiful bridge up in the mountains, and then eventually, like, I don't know, the towns or whatever weren't traveled as much, the roads deteriorated, and there was this beautiful bridge that had no way of getting to or from it. And the author kind of asks, and one of the things I like about the author is that he spends a lot of time asking questions and kind of leaving them pretty open-ended, leaving them for us. I mean, I think you could very easily draw a lot of conclusions and say, well, yeah, there are aspects of the church like this, but he just kind of leaves it there for us to talk about. And so the question, what we're going to address and start off with in chapter 1, the context of it is this idea of, are we, or what are the aspects, not are we, but what are the aspects of our church, what are the aspects in the ways in which we live and the way in which we operate in the church disconnected from the world in which we live? And I think there are ways in which we are much more disconnected than others. I think there are parts of our church that are much more connected than others. And we'll talk a little bit about this. And I just want everyone to know, just in my kind of teaching style or in these kinds of situations, if you have a question or a comment or anything, just raise your hand and jump in, because I'm always happy to kind of go on tangents. I love tangents. They're my favorite. Yeah, thank you, Sam. And so I wanted to start with this history piece. And so he goes all the way to the beginning. He talks about this very early movement of the church. He moves into the reality of as it's adopted and becomes the established church of the empire after Emperor Constantine, or during Emperor Constantine's rule. It moves into the Holy Roman Empire, where it becomes this very political thing, and where the church and the state are constantly vying for, you know, kind of authority and control. And I think he goes into a pretty good description of this, if you were able to read through it. And then our piece of it moves from the Holy Roman Empire up into specifically the Church of England, which you may have been surprised to find out. When we talk about the Church of England now, we're obviously talking about the Anglican Church, the Anglican Communion. But originally, it was just the Roman Catholic, you know, arm of the church in Great Britain. That's what was the Church of England. And it wasn't until the Protestant Reformation and the Protestant Revolution and the kind of fighting in England that established it as a Protestant tradition. From the Church of England, it moves. Remember, England conquers almost a third of the world, right? And where it goes, it took its institutionalized religion with it to all these places. And if you recall the stories of, you know, of our colonization of the New World, of the United States and North America and parts of Africa and India, Australia, you know, there was a lot of conquest that was a part of it. You know, there was a lot of, you know, kind of mission work at the point of a gun, right? Because the understanding was, this is who we are, this is how we operate, we have the truth, and we are going to take it to you, whether you like it or not, because it's the best thing for you. And in more subtle ways, I think we still have that element in our church today, unfortunately. But it's not quite as aggressive. Well, maybe it's just as aggressive. It's not quite as dangerous, we'll say, physically speaking. And then from the colonies, we move to where we are today, and the establishment of the kind of American tradition and heritage of Christianity that is fragmented into many, many different expressions over the last, you know, 200-300 years. Does anyone have any questions about any aspect of that? I mean, there's a lot. He goes through a lot of history. He goes through a lot very quickly in the book. I think it's helpful, but I don't want to spend a ton of time on it if it kind of makes sense to everyone. Does anyone have anything they'd like to respond to or have any comments about it? I think the most important piece of this, as we talk some more, is the way we focus on this concept that he writes about as we move into having an established church, and from an established church to moving into an establishment church. I think that was a very helpful thing for us. And if you haven't been an Episcopalian for, you know, 50 years, it might not be as familiar for you. but he talks a little bit about it, and I have some notes in here. The Episcopal Church in the middle of the 20th century was a very powerful, powerful church, and before that as well. Most of our presidents, you know, most of our congress people, senators and congressmen, were all Episcopalian. They were Episcopalians, and they had a lot of money, and they had a lot of power. And a lot of that kind of continues to this day. We're much smaller. We don't have as much political influence, but still, if you look at the statistics, as he talks about in the book, we generally tend to be much wealthier, much more educated as kind of the members of our churches than the average, we'll say. And so part of what we need to think about is how we move away from that sense of establishment and move more into a place of community and a place of welcome, a place for everyone. Because the church is a place for everyone. It's not a place just for the elite or just for those in need. It's a church for all. And the transition that he talks about is the established church was just when, you know, it was a part of the culture. It was how the state ran. And so the state ran, and the church was at the center of it. Life centered around the church. You know, we're talking about having a farmer's market here, right? Well, that was every church. You know, you came to church. In the eaves of the church, the vendors would sell their goods. After church got out on Sunday, you would go home and you would have your Sunday meal. That was the way of life. I mean, everything centered around the church. Remember, there weren't clocks. People didn't keep time. They saw the sun in the sky. They knew it was getting dark soon. That was about the extent of our timekeeping. You know, and you worked when you needed to work, which was most of the time. You didn't work on the holy day. You didn't work on Sunday when you celebrated and worshiped. That was your day off. And you knew it was the day off because it was, you know, because of the church calendar, the way the pace and the life of the church defined everything in life. And that was the kind of established church. And then as that started to change, and we'll talk more about that in the second chapter, but as that started to change, we start seeing these kind of different pieces of the church evolve. And in our particular expression in the Episcopal Church, we start seeing this very powerful kind of elite rising because our founding fathers, you know, all of the people of influence in the early days of our country, you know, were a part of the Church of England. And the Church of England itself lost its presence here because we had this revolution and we decided we didn't like England very much, and so we sure weren't going to be a part of England or their church. But we still had an Episcopal and an Anglican tradition, and so the Episcopal Church kind of rose out of that. And in the late 1800s, in the 1700s into the 1800s, you know, we start seeing the Episcopal Church develop. And for a long time, it's called the National Church, right? Until just recently, the headquarters in New York City was called the National Church. You know, that's what the people would say, the National Church, and they meant the Episcopal Church headquarters. They're getting away from that now. They're trying to discourage that term, but that was what it was called. The seminary, Virginia Theological Seminary, down in Alexandria, Virginia, was called the seminary. If you go to their website, it's, you know, someone's email at Virginia, a professor, is like, so-and-so at theseminary.edu. If you're the bishop of the Diocese of Virginia is, you know, bishop so-and-so at thediocese.net or whatever it is, .org. I mean, it's remarkable, really. It was this very strong presence. And that is where a lot of the identity of the church, implicit or explicit, might not even realize it, but a lot of the aspects of just our church and the way we live, the way we worship, has influence in that, you know, have been affected by that. Does that make sense? I think a really good example, this wasn't in the book at all, but this is just a fact from our last budget. Every 3 years, we have a general convention in the Episcopal Church, and that's when everyone gets together and makes all the major changes and votes on all the legislation in our church. And in 2012, the budget that they initially proposed down to the budget committee had $700,000 to be spent over 3 years lobbying Congress, as if Congress cares at all what, you know, the million of us have to say. Like, we're going to spend all this money, and we basically had cut most of the youth budget out of the National Church. Now, you can make an argument that youth work is more effective on a local level, and you know, I mean, there's arguments to be made, but the reality that we're going to spend a whole lot of money lobbying Congress and not spending it on youth programs on a national level is just kind of silly. Thankfully, the rest of the church thought that was absurd too, and they changed it, but it was kind of, it's just one of those, a little piece of that illustration, that sense of what should we be doing with our time? we should be influencing the things of this country. If you look at a lot of the resolutions still that are passed, we pass resolutions at General Convention, you know, in support of the Palestinian right to be a state, you know, and these kinds of very political things, because you have a lot of these folks who are very socially and politically active, who get very active in the national church and become deputies in their diocese, and they bring a lot of that social justice feel to the national church. That's why you hear all these things out of General Convention that caused a lot of distress for a lot of the congregants and people in Pittsburgh. It's what led a lot of the fuel to the fire and the split here, five, 6 years back, was because you hear all these crazy things coming out of the national kind of level of the politics of the church. And it was really hard, unless you were hearing, you know, things from both sides, it was very easy just to hear the one side saying, look at all this crazy stuff that's being done. There's lots of really good stuff being done too, but you know, you don't hear about that as much because the stuff that gets the press, the stuff that everyone focuses on and talks about, are these like really niche things that people are really invested in. You know, this group of people is really invested in and are trying to influence, you know, the things of our country, the things of our world through it. So that's a little bit of the background there. And moving from there, and what I think is unfortunate is that much of our understanding of mission is wrapped up in this idea of power. And I really liked his description of the idea of how the benefactor kind of paradigm has grown out of that. And I think everyone here has seen this, right? I've talked about this a little bit last week, the checkbook ministry, you know. We had people at St. Paul's that talked about how we used to have this great checkbook ministry, you know. And I loved his treatment of it, because he didn't demean anyone. You know, they had that. He said, you know, and there is a place. There is a need for us to use, those of us that have wealth, that have money, that have that kind of influence, to use it for justice, to use it for good things, to use it for the furthering of God's work in the world. That's absolutely true. But I think he brings us back to center in also saying that while that is something we can do and should do because we have the means to do it, we have to do it in the context of a larger partnership. We have to do it in the context of coming together with the people that we serve, with the people that we benefit. And he uses that quote from Scripture, you know, they're arguing over who's the best, right, who's the most important. And Jesus says, you know, the people, the wealthy people, the powerful people of this world, you know, they do all these things and they lord it over. You know, they lord it over you. But I tell you, and I come to you as one who serves. Who's more important? The person that serves at the table, the person that is served? Well, you think it's the person that is served, but I'm going to tell you, I come to you as a servant. I come to you as one who's going to wash your feet. I come to you as one who is going to care for you when everyone else rejects you. That is the ministry of Jesus. That is who we are called to be. The incarnational reality, that's a big churchy word. Incarnation means the coming of God among us, to be incarnate in human beings and to be one of us. That's the idea of the incarnation. And I think we have to take that really seriously. We have to take the incarnation really seriously. Oh, poor Rosemary. But I want to play. And that was what Jesus came to do. He came into this world to be among us, to be with us. He didn't just send the Holy Spirit, right? He came and lived among us. And I think that's a really important piece we have to remember. You know, we can't just write checks. We can't just do this thing and help out over here. We have to invite partnership. We have to invite people to be a part of that with us. And that is an incredibly important piece of who we are and what we're about. And I think this is where it ties in very much also with where Bishop McConnell wants us to go and who he wants us to be as a diocese and as a people. He very much wants us to start looking into ways of how we can not just go out into our community and do things for them, you know, not just have a soup kitchen or not just provide food for the food bank, not just do these individual services, which are important and necessary and we should do, and that's a part of our ministry. But also, how do we build a partnership and how do we invite the people in our community into what we're doing? And not just invite them to church so that we have a bigger church. I mean, that is a great thing, and I think there's a lot here that people can receive. But also, just how do we engage them? How do we work with them? And I can't remember if I mentioned this last week, and for those of you that weren't here, I'll say it, I'll kind of repeat it. But there was this great example of where one of these kind of wealthier churches was doing a lot to support an inner city church that didn't have as many means, right? And so their minister went down and would preach for them, you know, one Sunday a quarter or one Sunday a year or something like that. They would send money down. They would send people with meals down to help out the people in their neighborhood and things like that. And someone was talking to them about this, and they were so happy and proud of everything they were doing. And they should be. They were doing some great work. But the person they were talking to said, and I honestly can't remember where I read this or where I heard this, but he said, well, and what happens, what's it like when they come, when they send someone to preach at your church? And they kind of looked at him like, what do you mean? That's never happened before. And I think that's a really good example of that kind of one-sided, one-way relationship. And that's not what God calls us into in this world. God calls us into partnership. I was just talking with, we had this great opportunity. I don't know if you've met her yet, but someone who's been in church fairly regularly the last couple months is the Reverend Kathy Lalone. I'm not sure if you met her. She has a real, she's an accent. She's lovely, dark hair, lovely woman. She's a retired priest in the diocese. And she has been very involved in work in Uganda. She was a part of a board that started an orphanage in Hoima, Uganda. And they take a mission trip called the Mission of Hope. Every January they go and they run VBS and they spend time with the kids in the orphanage. And they're committed to raising the funds so that all the kids in that orphanage are able to be educated up to the highest level that they are able to attain. Because in Uganda, education is not a given. You have to have the means to be educated. And so they support these kids and not only give them a place to live and a home and a family, but provide for them so that they can be educated. And that's a big piece of what Kathy's ministry and mission in this world is. And we were talking about it because as she's settling here at St. David's, now that she's retired, she was talking to us, and I'm going to talk to the vestry this next month about how can we support them, you know, because they need some tax shelter. You know, they need a pass-through for them to raise money through and things. And there's different ways in which we can help them. And one of the things, because I'm thinking in this way and thinking this way, I would normally just think, well, what can we do in order to send people and to support your work there? And we started having a conversation about how there's some kids over there who are starting to graduate college, university. They're in university. They have one young person who has just graduated a year or so ago, and there are four other kids who are in university. You know, these are those first kids as they've grown up, and it's about 20 years that this program, this orphanage has been there, and they're just starting to see some of the youngest kids grow into that age. And where I would normally just think, well, how can we serve them? I was thinking, well, what can we do? Is there a way we can engage them? Or is there any of these kids that are in university or that are graduating that would want to come here and minister to us and tell us what, you know, what their experience has been and how, you know, we can have a different perspective on things and what their understanding of life and growing up in Africa and at the baby's home, what that meant for them. Maybe they can come and work with our VBS, you know what I mean, for a week. And share that peace with us. How can we start partnerships? That's just kind of a picture of that. Does that make sense? And we'll get in. And this one note down here, I think, is something that is really good, but it comes up later in the book, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But this idea of the way Jesus sends out the 70, you know, sends them out two by two, and tells them not to take anything with them, and tells them to go be guests in other people's houses. And we just kind of hear that and we read it and we don't think much of it, at least I don't, because it's one of those Bible stories I've heard 1,000 times. But when you think about it, I think I mentioned it last week, think about going out into the community and knocking on doors of strangers' houses in towns you've never been to and saying, can I stay here? Can I crash here for a while? You know, I mean, think about how outside of our comfort zone that would be, you know? And that's what Jesus tells them to do. Not just go and take this good news, not just go and take the gospel, but also, you know, receive. Receive from the people. We're not always that great at receiving, and it's an important part of life. There's just a couple kind of notes at the end of this, just in my sense that the church, and kind of my opinion, my perspective, that the church isn't really called to be a place or an institution of power. You know, for a long time, for many years, for thousands of years, the church, not quite thousands, but over 1,000 years, the church has really been in a seat of power and in control. And we're starting to move into a time where that's not the case so much. I mean, there's still plenty of power in the church, don't get me wrong. But it's waning in a way that we're not used to and we're not very comfortable with. And I think it's a good place for us to move into, because if you think about the ministry of Jesus, it was a ministry out of weakness. It was a ministry out of humility and out of need to offer, you know, what is good for this world. And I think we have a lot to learn and a lot to take from that. And so that's kind of my thoughts on the first chapter. Does anyone have any comments or questions? I have a couple questions here for discussion. One, tell a story of where you met God, and was it in a church or was it somewhere else? And what have your experiences of mission been like? Would people be more comfortable just kind of breaking up for a few minutes and talking about that with just the folks that you're sitting near? Do we want to just kind of have a conversation here? What do people feel like? What do you want? Sorry? Just here? All right. Do any thoughts or any? Is that okay? I mean, I want us to be able to engage and like, you know, I want to hear your thoughts a little bit on this. So, and I actually had another question on here. It might have been on here last week because I had these same questions, but, you know, tell us about a story of where you met God, and was it in the church or elsewhere? And then I think I said, you know, is even asking this question make you a little uncomfortable? Because one of the premises of this book is that we've become very nervous and very anxious about talking about God. Because our world, and we'll talk about this in chapter 2, has become more secularized. And so we expect God to be kind of in this place called church, and then out in the rest of the world, that's not where God belongs. And we've kind of got to talk about how do we come back to bridging that gap. Now, not throwing it in someone's face, not, you know, insulting or not pushing people or not being, you know, making other people uncomfortable in this, you know, awful way. But just there is something here that is real. There is something here that has touched our lives. And there's something here that a lot of those folks can probably identify and relate to and would be of help to them. How do we bridge that gap? So we'll talk a little bit about that. But just some thoughts. What are people's experiences, if you're willing to share?